This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents The Final Life of Nathaniel Moon, Book 4 of the Middle Falls Time Travel Series. Written by Sean Inman. Performed by Adam Verner. Chapter 1. Victoria Schmidt was engaged to be married on her 12th birthday. She was married in a secret ceremony on her 13th. The ceremony was secret because even with parental permission, minors under the age of 16 were not allowed to be married in Minnesota. The marriage was not Victoria's idea. She was opposed in every way and made her opinion known as strongly as she was able. It did not matter because the marriage had been arranged by Elijah Shepherd, in his role as the spiritual leader of the New Believers movement, an offshoot of a spin-off of a splinter that derived from a faith no one could trace back to its initial roots. Mr. Shepherd, who had been born Herb Finkelbaum, had 19 wives and took 2 new teen brides each year, one on the summer solstice and another on the winter. When Victoria's father told her she was betrothed, she had said, "I won't go." "You will," William said, removing his belt. Bruised and battered, she went. Victoria was repulsed by the groom Shepherd had chosen for her. Dick Dillon, a 56-year-old insurance salesman almost 20 years older than her father. His previous wife, Linda, had passed away the year before. The coroner's report had listed Linda's death as death by misadventure, but the scuttlebutt around the New Believers compound was that her fall from the cliff while hiking had not been completely accidental. The one blessing of the union was that Dick Dillon was diabetic and had been rendered sterile a number of years before. His only offspring would be his son, Derek, who was 3 years older than Victoria and who had moved away as soon as he turned 18. Derek had never adjusted well to having a stepmother who was younger than he was. Victoria suspected that although he paid it lip service, Derek was no more a true believer than she was, which put his belief at approximately 0. By her 14th birthday, Victoria was a wife in all ways but in the eyes of the law, and was charged with running a household. Over time, she took an interest in Dick's business, if not in Dick himself, and showed a natural aptitude with math and double-entry accounting. Before she was 16, she took over the bookkeeping duties for his insurance office. Dick Dillon was an unpleasant man by any standard. He wasn't attractive, with bad teeth, hair too scant to be called thinning, and he somehow managed to be both too thin, with angular jutting legs and arms, and too fat, with a heavy paunch that swayed when he walked. He was also given to bursts of anger that resulted in violence. While Derek was still living at home, it had been kept in check. But when it was just he and Victoria, it had escalated quickly. She had nowhere to run, no one to turn to. The true believers held to the idea that the man was king of his castle and responsible for his own business within the castle walls, no matter what that might entail. That meant that even her own parents turned a deaf ear to her pleas, although her mother had the good grace to at least look pained as she turned her back on her only daughter. Over time, Victoria became adept at reading moods at a glance and adjusting her own life accordingly, which kept the outbursts and violence to a minimum. Victoria spent every minute thinking of how to make her escape, but she had no money and no way to get any. The only transportation she had was the 61 Mercury Monterey in the garage that barely ran, which Dick left for her to run errands around town, knowing it would never hold up for a longer trip. Her indentured servitude lasted for nearly 10 years. In December of 1978, just after Victoria had turned 22, Derek Dillon returned home for an extended holiday visit. He hadn't been home for many years, and he had grown into a strong young man whose good looks reflected his mother's side of the family. On his arrival, he was shocked to find the young, spirited girl he remembered, cowed and quiet. meekly waiting on his father and doing as she was told. When the elder Dylan went to work, and Derek and Victoria were left alone, she stood taller and became more like the girl he remembered. Derek saw the impact that life with his father had on her, and his heart went out to her. Over the month-long visit, Victoria found what she never had before. Kind words, a smile, shared conversation, and, inevitably, infatuation of a sort. Over lunch one day, Derek said, "Did you and Dad ever get legally married?"
"No. From the time the leader married us, everyone here considered us married, and that was all that really mattered to him. My dad mentioned it to him once after I turned 16, and he promised he would arrange for it. But then Dad died not long after, and it was never mentioned again."
Derek nodded, swirling his iced tea around the bottom of his glass thoughtfully.
"That's not necessarily a bad thing, is it?"
Victoria flushed and cleared the dishes away, but Derek's deep blue eyes wouldn't leave her memory. Over the next few weeks, nature took its course, and the two of them could hardly wait for Dick to leave for work in the morning. One afternoon, as they lay naked on the bed in the guest room, Derek said, "I know this has happened fast enough to make our heads spin, but love strikes like lightning." Victoria considered. "Is this love?"
"No, of course not. But a smile and a kind word is so much better than anything else I've seen. It's closer to love than anything else I've ever known."
"I've taken a job in Louisiana. When I get there, I'll be staying on company property at first, but by summer I'll be able to be on my own. I'd love it if you'd come down and be with me."
"I'm sure there are 1,000 pretty girls in New Orleans.
None like you. I love you, Victoria."
Love was pledged. A pact was made. Victoria agreed that if Derek would come back in a few months, when his father was away at work, she would be packed and ready to run. They both agreed that they would never see Dick Dylan again. With an eye toward that, Derek gave him completely wrong information about where he was going to work. Derek left her with a few $100, nearly all the money he had in the world, in case she needed to get away sooner and come to him. Victoria counted down the days. A month later, on Valentine's Day, Dick was gone on a short business trip when Victoria awoke to the phone ringing and horrible nausea. When she answered the phone, she heard a recorded voice say, "Are you paying too much for your mortgage? We can..." Before she realized, she was going to throw up and hung up. Victoria rushed to the kitchen sink and threw up the previous night's dinner. She hung over the porcelain edge for several minutes, waiting for the waves of dizziness and nausea to pass. Just when she felt like she could stand, the phone rang again. She weaved her way to the phone and answered,
"Hello?"
There was a waver in her voice.
"You okay? You don't sound so good."
"I woke up sick this morning, probably just a bug. I'm sure I'll be better now that I threw up."
"All right. My flight got delayed, so I won't be home until later tonight. You'll need to have dinner ready an hour later or so."
"Yes, sir,"
Victoria said, then numbly hung up the phone. By the time Dick arrived home that night, she had thrown up half a dozen more times and was lying miserably on the couch, too weak to move. She looked so poorly, Dick was afraid she might be dying, and quickly drove her to the emergency room. As the doctor examined her, she threw up again in a wastebasket in the corner. He gave her a promethazine suppository to stop the vomiting, which took effect quickly and gave her some relief. Victoria, despite being in her early 20s and essentially a married woman for a decade, was still an innocent in many ways. The doctor was not. While he had her there, he took some blood so he could run another test and asked Dick and Victoria to wait there in the exam room. For the purposes of the hospital visit, the doctor had been told that Victoria was Dick's daughter. When the doctor returned half an hour later, Victoria was already feeling a little better, sitting up, ready to return home.
"Feeling better?" the doctor asked.
Victoria, looking down at the floor, nodded.
Good. Well, the doctor shifted from one foot to another. I never know if this is good news or not, but I found the cause of your nausea. You're pregnant.
Victoria's eyes widened, and the color drained from her face, but she did not lift her eyes.
Are you sure, doctor? That should be impossible.
Dylan's voice was strained.
There's always a chance of a false positive, even with a blood serum test. But it's highly unlikely, especially given her other symptoms. Tender breasts and abdomen vomiting.
The doctor cleared his throat.
Well, there it is. I've written a prescription for more of the suppositories if the vomiting should return after this one wears off.
He tore a sheet off his prescription pad and handed it to Dick, then hurried out of the room. Dylan roughly grabbed Victoria and pulled her off the table.
Get your ass in the car,
he whispered, his breath foul and hot in her ear. It was a quiet drive back to the house they had shared for 10 years. The wheels of Victoria's mind spun, but could find no purchase. Pregnant. As surreptitiously as possible, she moved her hand to her stomach.
Pregnant.
Back at home, Dylan opened the passenger door and dragged her up the steps and into the house. As soon as the door closed behind him, he threw her down on the floor.
You are impure, a Jezebel, whore!
His voice grew louder with each word. He aimed a vicious kick at her midsection, but Victoria rolled on her side and absorbed the kick in her back. She cried out in pain.
If I lay here, he will kill me this time. He will kick me until I'm dead.
With a wince, she scrambled onto all fours and crawled away from him. She reached the couch and pulled herself up on all fours. He was on her, raining his fists down on her head and shoulders, knocking her to her knees again.
Stop!
She cried, holding an arm up to ward off the worst of the blows. She stumbled backward and fell across the couch. She looked up into his face, distorted with anger, tiny flecks of spittle clinging to his lower lip.
This is your grandchild.
The truth of her words, and the realization of what that meant, pushed him beyond anger to insane rage. He fell on her, straddled her, and wrapped his hands around her throat. His lips pulled back from his teeth as he used every bit of strength he had to choke her to death. Victoria pushed back, gasping for breath, but she was already weak and could feel her remaining strength draining from her. She thought of her baby, so incredibly tiny, but already growing inside her.
Please, God, I don't care about me, but save my baby, please.
It was her final conscious thought, as Dick Dylan choked her until she died. Victoria woke up to a telephone ringing loudly.
What? Where am I?
Her hands went to her throat, but there were no bruises. She swung her feet out of bed and realized she was nauseous, and that damned phone won't quit ringing. She ran to the phone, paying for the effort with an increased wave of sickness in every step. She grabbed the phone and said,
Yes?
A recorded voice said, Are you paying too much for your mortgage? We can save you thousands of dollars over the life of... Before she slammed the phone down. At that moment, she remembered everything. The throwing up, the doctor's visit, Dick killing her. She looked wildly around, but was alone in the house. What in the hell happened? The last thing I remember is him straddling me, choking me, and then... I died. I know it, but here I am. How is that possible? The phone rang again, and she picked it up and said, What now? Dick Dylan's voice came from the other end of the line.
Whoa, now, we've talked about the proper way to answer the phone. I know it's not a business, but sometimes clients call me at home, too, and we've got to treat them professionally.
Huh? What? Are you okay? You don't sound well.
I'm not well.
I'm sick. In fact, I think I'm about to throw up. I'm going to go.
Just wanted to let you know my flight got delayed, so you'll need to delay dinner.
Victoria dropped the phone back in its cradle with a clatter and ran to the kitchen sink, where she threw up dinner from the night before. There should be nothing left to throw up. I threw it all up yesterday. What the hell is going on? And why is he calling, acting like everything is normal? Victoria's hand dropped to her stomach.
I'm alive. I'm pregnant. I'm living the same day over again.
I don't know how, and it doesn't matter. I'm going to get the hell out of here, now. She retrieved the money hidden in her closet that Derek had left her, grabbed a suitcase, threw a few clothes in, and ran to the garage. She stopped at the doorway to the garage to throw up again, but didn't bother to stop to clean it up. She paused and looked back into the house. Anything else I want to take? Her eyes swept the kitchen, the door to the bedroom, the living room. Nope. Dick thought she couldn't go anywhere in the Mercury, because he took what he thought was the only key when he left town. But Victoria had made a copy of it 2 years before. She tossed her suitcase in the back seat and slid behind the wheel. She turned the key, trying to remember the last time it had been started. The motor was sluggish, but eventually it turned over. She took a deep breath, put the car in reverse, and backed out of the garage, leaving the garage door open. She drove straight to Highway 73, turned an hour south to Floodwood. When she looked at the gas gauge for the first time, it was pegged past empty. She coasted into a Shell station on fumes, filled the tank, and picked up a road atlas, blowing a necessary part of her small resources. Her nausea returned in a sudden tidal wave, and she barely had a chance to open the door before she vomited again. She stopped at a small drugstore, bought a bottle of Pepto-Bismol, and chugged a quarter of the bottle with a grimace. Nothing else for it. I've got to keep going. She sat behind the wheel, considering. Got to be smart about this. Where to? Derek, I guess. It's what I was going to do anyway. Can he protect me from his father, though? Would he kill both of us? Will he believe me that he already killed me once and I woke up just fine? Let's not worry about that. She connected with Interstate 35 and drove straight through until the needle on the gas tank once again approached empty. By then she was in Iowa. Victoria filled up again, realized how little money she actually had, and began to cry. She cried until she was done. That's it. No more. It's not just me. This little person inside of me is relying on me now. She drove until she was too drowsy to go on, then found a rest area and pulled over. Should have brought a blanket. I've got to start planning things out better. Victoria opened the suitcase, found the warmest clothes she had brought, and put them on over what she was wearing, then bundled up in her coat and sat back down behind the steering wheel. She had a hard time relaxing, with people parking and moving around her, but eventually she began to drift off to sleep. Just as sleep approached, she felt the baby inside her. No way! It's got to be imagination. It's way too early for that. It wasn't a physical kick she felt, though. It was an awareness, a feeling that she wasn't alone anymore. Out loud, she said, "Baby, is that you? I can feel you." Chapter 2. Dimension AG-54298, M25736. 1979. He came awake, but did not open his eyes, for they were not formed yet. His body went on about its work, turning soft cartilage into bones, and building all the organs he would eventually need to exist outside his mother's womb. He paid this process no mind, but focused inward. His first thoughts were of the life he had just left. His death was still fresh in his memory. He had been an old man, skin stretched paper thin, eyes watery, strength gone, surrounded by a family who loved him enough to let him go.
Susan, thank you for letting me go. I was tired of the pain. I suffered from the limited perspective of the living. I didn't know what was next, but I was ready to find out. He stretched his consciousness out, looking for what had occurred between letting go of his old body and beginning to build this one. When he focused his memory, he saw his life force leave the old body and move into a dimension invisible to the living. He watched his soul wriggle and frolic like a pollywog let loose in a fast-moving stream. And then he came awake, here, in his slowly building body. Good enough. He spent an unmeasured time reviewing that life. From the distance of a new life, he felt detached from the successes, the failures of what had once been so important. He dwelled on a few of his memories. His daughter's tiny hand wrapped entirely around a single one of his fingers, as they walked along the shore of a gently lapping lake. Standing in the bow of his fishing boat, lost in a sunset. Sitting in a cafe with his friends. He savored the connections with those he loved. He saw the times he had fallen down and failed both himself and those who loved him. He took those memories into his heart and held them tight. He wanted to carry them into this new life so he would not repeat them. Every mistake teaches us something, but if we refuse to learn it, then it's all for nothing. Beyond his most recent life was a long stretch of previous lives. He could look at any of them in as much detail as he wished, but simply skimmed through them. They were of interest to him in the same way an adult might look back on the early lessons of childhood, only in passing. He did notice patterns, though. Similar failures, similar triumphs, and made note of them. He stood on the precipice of something new, and he was ready. Inside his head, he heard a voice. Baby, is that you? I feel you. Mother. Hello, Mother. Can you hear me? Oh, I can. What? I didn't expect this. Is this normal? A tinkling laugh filled Mother's mind. You are asking me questions? I am only moments old in this life. I knew you were special. I felt it. But I thought every mother believed their baby was special. I didn't expect this. He reviewed through all his lives, from womb to death. He did not find any where he communicated with his mother before being born. Are you still there? Is this all in my imagination? I think I might be losing my mind. I'm here. I was searching my past lives. This is unprecedented, at least for me. You can see your past lives? Yes. Will you always be able to see them? I don't remember anything about any life I've lived before, only this one. I will forget. I do not want to bring too much into this life with me, or I will limit what I can learn. That makes me sad. Can you bring those memories with you if you wish? Yes. This forgetting is voluntary? Yes. Do you know other things? The secrets of the universe? There are no secrets. I know. You know, or at least you have known. We forget so we can experience this life fully. Nathaniel? Is that my name in this life? He felt the word Nathaniel settle into him, become part of who he would be. It's a good name. Thank you. Will you do something for me? No answer. You are already so much smarter than me, Nathaniel, not answering until you know what I want. So here it is. Will you take part of what you know right now and make a place inside you where you can keep it safe? Somewhere you could find it again if you wanted. Is that even possible? It is. Will you do it for me? We are all alone, you and I am scared. I want to protect you, but I don't know if I will be able to.
Silence stretched out while Nathaniel looked at all paths that lay ahead and behind him.
I will.
I only want what's best for you.
Our perspectives when it comes to that are very different. I'm going to be quiet now. There is much to do.
Victoria smiled inwardly, knowing what a blessing this child would be. Nathaniel went about the business at hand, both forgetting and building a place within himself where he could access all that is never truly forgotten. Chapter 3 1983 Vivian Hanrahan, once known as Victoria Schmidt, sat in her cramped office, ledger books open in front of her, and Nathaniel on the floor beside her, coloring. A small fan in an open window did very little to move the stultifying air. It was a little past 10 a.m. in Tubal, Arkansas, and it was already 91 degrees outside. The kind of heat that wraps around you like a thick wool blanket and makes breathing seem like too much work.
Doesn't ever seem to bother you, though, does it, little man?
Nathaniel looked up from his coloring and said,
What, Mama?
This heat. She fanned the front of her blouse, but the air refused to stir.
No, I like it. It feels right.
Tubal, just north of the Louisiana state line, was an unusual landing spot for a young woman from Minnesota. It was the town she had been passing through on the way to New Orleans, when her old Mercury had given up the ghost right in front of the Get Gas Here sign, in front of Murdoch's gas station and pizzeria. As it turned out, Bill Murdoch also owned the wrecking yard in Tubal, and offered $100 cash for her car, which was likely more than it was worth. By the time the sun went down on her second day in Tubal, she was gainfully employed as a seamstress at the Creech Coat and Uniform Manufacturing Plant, just outside the city limits. She'd been pregnant, but still walked the 2 miles back and forth to work each day, until she had saved enough money to buy another old beater, just before Nathaniel was born. Once she had a little bit of money saved and a car again, she realized she could leave Tubal and finish her journey to Derrick and Louisiana. A year had passed, though, and whatever infatuation she had once felt for him had dissipated. Not long after that, Cyrus Creech himself had offered her the chance to get off the sewing floor and be his executive assistant and bookkeeper. Vivian accepted, as the floor was too damned hot 5 months out of the year, and too damn cold another 5 months. April and October were blissfully moderate. Also, Cyrus Creech was a genuine family man, and attached none of the strings to the promotion that many bosses did. She almost never brought Nathaniel with her to work, but on this day, her sitter, Andy, had called her, sick with the summer flu. It had been too late to find anyone else. So here they were, Vivian and her numbers and appointment books, Nathaniel and his colors. Nathaniel had been born in Tubal, which may have explained why he didn't mind the heat and humidity. He stuck his tongue out of the corner of his mouth as he concentrated on coloring the green grass in his picture, when a racket from the back of the building attracted the attention of both of them. Vivian's office was upstairs, on a catwalk that overlooked both the manufacturing floor and the shipping docks. She said, "Don't move, Nathaniel," and took one step outside the door of her office and peered down to see what had caused the commotion. Everything looked normal on the manufacturing floor. There were dozens of heavy-duty sewing machines, operated by women with hunched backs and nimble fingers, making corduroy coats by the gross. The chaos and confusion came from the loading dock. From her viewpoint 20 feet up, Vivian could see a forklift tipped on its side, wheels still spinning. Heavy boxes had been knocked into a massive, jumbled pile.
"Oh, God!"
Vivian said. She turned, plucked Nathaniel up off the floor, and hurried down the metal steps as fast as she could. At the back of the loading dock, half a dozen men were spread around the forklift, trying to lift it up, to no avail. Harry Spitton, who everyone called Pup, was pinned beneath it. He was unconscious, with a thin dribble of blood coming from his mouth and nose. Vivian didn't bother to ask what had happened. She just took control of the situation. She shouted, "Bob,
Can you use the other forklift to move this one?
Bob Mullen ran to the second forklift, fired it up, and maneuvered around the jumble of boxes until he was next to the tipped forklift. Two other men jumped in and fixed a strap around the forks of Bob's forklift and the cab of the second. Bob raised the forks until the strap was tense, then backed up. He didn't have enough torque to set it upright, but he did manage to lift the heavy machine a few inches. Three sets of hands grabbed Pup and pulled him out from under. Vivian took one look at Pup's prone form, then spotted Hazel, a middle-aged woman she had known when she worked on sewing floor.
Hazel, here, watch Nathaniel for me. I've got to go call an ambulance.
Hazel reached her arms out for Nathaniel. Vivian ran back up the metal stairs. There was no phone on the manufacturing floor. Hazel let Nathaniel slip down to the ground, but kept a hold on his small hand. Nathaniel tipped his head to the right, so he could look around the knees of the man in front of him. Pup stirred a little, and Bob Mullen kneeled down next to him and put a hand on his shoulder.
It's okay, Pup, just relax. Ambulance is on its way, and we'll get you to the hospital. You're gonna be just fine.
Harry's injuries weren't immediately obvious. There were no bones sticking out or pools of blood beneath him. The forklift had landed mainly on his torso, and he was struggling to draw a breath. He was deathly pale. His eyes fluttered open, and he gasped out,
"Can't breathe!"
The crowd surrounding him looked from one to another. The extent of their medical training was a single class on mouth-to-mouth resuscitation that everyone had joked their way through. While those around him dithered, Harry opened his mouth wide, a fish on a riverbank gasping for oxygen. He tried to lift his head up, but his eyes closed again, and his head slammed back into the concrete floor, unconscious. At the back of the crowd, someone shouted, "Do mouth to mouth!" Bob, who was kneeling next to Harry, laid a hand gently on Harry's chest and said,
"I think his chest is crushed. I don't want to make it any worse. I'm going to wait for the ambulance."
"He'll be dead by the time the danged ambulance gets here," someone muttered.
They had drawn the word ambulance out into many syllables. As Vivian hurried down the stairs, Hazel didn't notice that Nathaniel had let go of her hand. He was tiny and slipped between the men and women crowded around. He walked straight up to Harry and laid his small hand lightly on his chest, just as Bob Mullen had done.
"Bad. It's all bad inside him. Somewhere deep inside him, something unlocked, unbidden, and rose to his conscious mind. I can fix him."
For a brief moment, with his hand still on Pup's chest, Nathaniel closed his eyes and pictured him healed. Bob looked down and saw him then.
"Hey there, who's this? Who do you belong to?"
Bob picked Nathaniel up with one arm and looked around.
"Whose kid is this?"
Vivian hurried forward and plucked Nathaniel away from Bob.
"He's mine, sorry."
She touched Nathaniel's face and looked into his calm eyes.
"You okay, honey?"
Nathaniel nodded softly.
"Why wouldn't I be?"
Everyone's attention had turned to Nathaniel, and Harry lay momentarily forgotten. Forgotten until he opened his eyes and sat up. The color had returned to his face, and he was breathing normally.
"Holy shit, what happened to me?"
Harry asked with amazement. He reached a hand up to dab at the blood around his nose and mouth. Around him, everyone took a half step back, looking at a ghost. In the distance, the whine of an ambulance siren slowly grew nearer.
"The boxes shifted on the forklift while it was on the ramp, and a whole shooting match fell over right on top of you," Bob said. "We thought you was a goner for sure."
Harry patted himself up and down as if looking for a missing pack of smokes. He shook his head.
"Nope, I feel fine. Never better."
The stares of the crowd, wide-eyed now, turned from Harry to Nathaniel. Vivian cupped her hand on the back of Nathaniel's head and buried his face against her shoulder.
"Good,"
she said in Harry's direction.
"Glad you're feeling better."
She cocked her head in the direction of the siren. "Ambulance will be here any second, though, and I want you to get checked out." Harry shrugged.
"Sure, no problem.
but I'm pretty sure I'm fine.
Vivian, still holding Nathaniel against her, retreated to her office upstairs. She sat Nathaniel on her desk. He stared at her with his innocent blue eyes. Nathaniel, honey, did you do something to that man on the ground? Did you help him? Nathaniel stared at her thoughtfully for a few seconds, without saying anything. Is this bad? You look scared. Finally, he nodded. Do you know what you did? Silence stretched for several seconds, then, I fixed him. Do you know how you did that? He shook his head, no way to explain it. Just did it. Vivian took a step back and drew a deep breath. She had waited for a sign, but after 4 years, she had stopped thinking about it as much. After Nathaniel had spoken to her before he was born, she had thought he might pop out of the womb speaking a dozen languages and solving advanced equations. He had been a normal baby, though, albeit what any mother would call a good baby. He didn't fuss unless he was hungry, was sleeping through the night when he was only 3 months old, and self-soothed without a pacifier. As Dr. Gray had said at Nathaniel's 6-month checkup, if every baby was this good, we'd suffer from overpopulation because everybody would want one. Until that dripping hot July day, though, he had never done anything extraordinary. A soft tapping on the door to her office startled Vivian from her thoughts. Vivian? It was Cyrus Creech. He was a short, neat man in his mid-40s, given to dressing in linen suits and wearing hats that covered his thinning blonde hair. For a time, he had also worn a wispy mustache, but his wife had soon taken care of that grooming faux pas. Yes, Cyrus?
So, he drawled, I just got in the office, there's an ambulance in the parking lot, and I'm hearing some awful strange things.
He glanced at Nathaniel, who was once again sitting on the floor, coloring his picture.
What in the heck is going on?
Heck was the strongest curse word Cyrus ever used. Honestly, I'm not sure. There was an accident on the loading dock. A forklift fell on Pop and we all thought he was hurt pretty bad, but once they lifted it off him, he seemed okay. The paramedics are checking him out to make sure. Cyrus pierced her with a look, but just tapped his fingers against her doorframe.
Okay, then. Find Bob Mullen and send him up to see me, please.
Downstairs, the medics loaded Harry into the ambulance over his protests and took him off to the hospital 5 miles down the road in Dodge City. Chapter 4. By the next day, Andy had recovered from her summer flu, so she kept Nathaniel. Shortly after Vivian settled in for the day, Cyrus Creech appeared in her doorway.
Viv, can you come down to my office for a minute?
Of course, I'll grab my notepad.
No need, just bring yourself.
Vivian stood up, smoothed the wrinkles from her shirt, and followed Cyrus down the narrow hallway to his office. The Creech coat and uniform building was, at best, utilitarian, and that extended to the president's office. The floor was covered in old linoleum, and the only furniture in the office were 3 filing cabinets, a large wooden desk with a swivel chair behind it, and 2 wooden chairs in front. A picture of a waving United States flag hung on the wall. It was the only decoration in the room, aside from a hinged double picture frame with Mrs. Creech and his son, Byron on one side, and a picture of Jesus on the other. Bob Mullen was already seated in one of the wooden chairs.
Please, Vivian, have a seat.
Cyrus moved around behind the desk and said,
Now we have a mystery on our hands here. You told me yesterday that a forklift fell on Harry, but after a few minutes he was okay. That's borne out by the hospital, who said they couldn't find one thing wrong with him.
Yes, sir, Vivian said.
Now Bob here has a slightly different take on things. He says that right after Harry was pulled out, he laid his hand on his chest to feel for a heartbeat, and that his chest felt like a bowl of oatmeal. Isn't that right, Bob?
As best I remember it, yes, sir.
It's difficult for me to reconcile how both of these things are so, even though it appears to be the case.
He nodded at Bob.
Okay, Bob, let's figure out what caused the accident in the first place and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Bob nodded, glad to be dismissed, and stood up to leave. Vivian stood up too, but Cyrus said,
"Hold on a minute, Vivian."
She sat back down. Bob left and shut the door to the office behind him.
"Vivian, you've worked here for 4 years now. I know you. I know what kind of person you are. But this is a mystery, isn't it? The people who were there saw your little boy walk up to a man who was either dead or dying and lay his hand on him. A minute later, he was up walking around, right as rain."
"Cyrus, you know people believe a lot of silly things." She smiled. "Heck, people believe the Falcons are going to play good football this year." The joke sailed high and wide.
"Have you ever noticed anything strange or unusual about your son?"
"Of course not," she shot back, any trace of a smile instantly gone. "He's just a little boy." Cyrus leaned back in his chair, steepled his fingers, and nodded thoughtfully.
"Fair enough, Vivian. That'll be all."
A week went by, then a month. A good month in which Nathaniel produced no further miracles. He didn't turn his white milk into chocolate, nor did he walk across the municipal swimming pool when Vivian took him. She hoped that the miracle of pup would fade from everyone's mind. That seemed to be the case until one evening in early August, when Cyrus Creech showed up on the porch of Vivian's small rental house. She was finishing dinner when the knock came on the door. She opened it to find Cyrus dressed much more casually than normal, in a pair of khakis and a blue button-down shirt with the sleeves rolled halfway up, revealing thin white arms. Over Cyrus's shoulder, Vivian could see his late-model Cadillac parked at the curb.
"Sorry to bother you at home, Vivian, but I just got back from Little Rock."
Vivian nodded. "Yes, sir, that's no problem." Cyrus, his wife, and little boy had been making increasingly frequent trips to the children's hospital in Little Rock, but Vivian wasn't sure why. Cyrus wrung his hands.
"I know you're cooking dinner. It smells delicious. I hate to bother you, but could I come in for just a moment?"
Vivian stepped back and opened the door wide. "Of course. Come in. Is Mrs. Creech with you?" Vivian asked, looking out toward the Cadillac.
"No, she's with Byron," Cyrus said, stepping across the threshold.
He looked down at the floor, nervous about his errand. When he met Vivian's eyes, he looked as if he was in pain.
"I really do hate to bother you, but it's important. Can we sit down?"
"Of course. Here, please take a seat on the sofa. I'll be right back. I just need to check on dinner. We're having meatloaf, which isn't Nathaniel's favorite, so he won't mind dinner being put back a bit." She glanced down at Nathaniel, who was looking at a picture book in the middle of the floor. "Nathaniel, put away your book and say hello to Mr. Creech." Vivian disappeared around the corner to the kitchen, and Nathaniel did as he was told, closing his favorite picture book, which had long-necked dinosaurs on the cover, and sat on the couch next to Cyrus.
"Hello. He is so sad. I feel the weight of it."
"Hello, Nathaniel." Cyrus reached out to shake Nathaniel's hand. "You like dinosaurs, eh?"
Nathaniel nodded and said,
"Yes. Crocodiles are almost the same now as they were millions of years ago."
A small burst of surprised laughter came out of Cyrus.
"Yes, that's right. You're a smart boy, aren't you?"
Nathaniel shrugged.
"I saw it on a show."
"Why do adults think kids are dumb? Just because we don't talk about something doesn't mean we don't know." Vivian reemerged from the kitchen, wiping her hands on a dish towel. She sat down in the chair next to the sofa and said, "Okay, you have my undivided attention." Cyrus nodded.
"This is very difficult for both Alice and me. We haven't talked about it with anyone else, because that makes it even more real. But Byron has been a sick little boy for quite a while now. They're doing everything they can for him up at Children's Hospital, but today they kept him there."
He paused and looked out the window at the children running and playing in the street.
"We're afraid he might not get to come home this time."
"Oh, Cyrus," Vivian said, scooting forward on the chair. "I didn't know. I'm so sorry. Is there something I can do at work to make this any easier for you? Any responsibilities I can take over?
Cyrus looked at her bleakly for a long moment, as if he wasn't quite following.
Oh, no. We've got everything set up at the factory so that it's running like a finely tuned machine. No, that's not it.
He looked up at the old ceiling tiles, stained by years of previous smokers living there. He cleared his throat.
No, what I was wondering is... Alice and I, that is... We were wondering if you would mind riding up to Little Rock with us tomorrow and bringing Nathaniel?
Vivian sat back in the chair a bit.
What? Why? What in the world would be the purpose of that?
Cyrus shook his head.
The thing is...
His voice lacked strength and tailed off.
The thing is, when you're faced with losing something, someone who means the world to you, even a tiny chance, seems big. But we're even running out of tiny chances.
Vivian leaned forward. I'm not following what you mean at all.
You're going to make me come out and say it. All right. We're hoping that Nathaniel could do for Byron what he did for Pup.
Vivian sat all the way back, surprise etched on her face.
Oh, Cyrus, you can't believe all that nonsense, can you?
It gets in your head when you hear about a miracle and you need a miracle yourself. I would do anything if I could take this on myself, but I can't. And watching our boy slip away is the hardest thing I've ever done.
Vivian shook her head.
There wasn't a miracle. Nathaniel is just a little boy, and that's all I want him to be.
I know it's likely that's all your little boy is, but it would mean everything to Alice and me if you would bring him to visit. Then we can put this out of our minds and focus on just saying goodbye.
Vivian cocked her head. She looked at Nathaniel sitting quietly beside Cyrus on the couch.
I can't imagine what it would be like to be in your position.
She drummed her fingers on the arm of the chair, made up her mind.
All right. We'll come with you. But you've got to agree to just let Nathaniel visit Byron. Nothing else. No hoodoo, voodoo, no expectations. I sympathize with what you're going through. I really do. But my first responsibility is to Nathaniel.
Cyrus flashed a relieved smile, and nodding said,
Yes, I understand. Of course you don't want to expose him to that kind of pressure and expectations. If you'll just be willing to come with us to the hospital, that's all I would ask.
Vivian stood up and reached a hand toward Nathaniel, who hopped down off the couch and held it.
Alice stayed up in Little Rock, of course, but I'm going to sleep at the house tonight. I'd like to leave for the hospital about 8 o'clock in the morning. Is that too early?
Vivian nodded down at Nathaniel.
8? God no, this little man is an early riser. We're up and at him by 6 every morning.
For a brief moment, it looked as though Cyrus was going to hug Vivian. But instead, he just smiled, nodded, and said,
I'll see you in the morning.
Chapter 5. It was an uncomfortable ride north to Little Rock. Vivian had packed puzzle books and comics to keep Nathaniel occupied, but conversation between the adults, which normally focused on production schedules, ordering raw materials, and keeping unions away from the workers, lagged. When the unstated aim of the trip was to find out whether a young boy could perform miracles unseen since biblical times, chatting about lesser things seemed unworthy. And so they drove up Highway 167, past Hardee's, come-and-go gas stations, and Waffle House restaurants, mostly in silence. When they pulled into the parking lot at Children's Hospital, Vivian turned to Nathaniel in the back seat.
Unbuckle, honey, and then we're going to visit with Mr. Creech's wife and son. He's very sick, so I'll need you to be a big boy.
Nathaniel unbuckled and stepped out of the cool of the Cadillac into the steamy late summer heat. He took Vivian's hand as they walked toward the hospital. Once inside, Vivian's hand tightened as they followed Cyrus through the maze of corridors, turns, and elevators. His certain pace showed his familiarity with the facilities. Eventually, they stepped out of an elevator on the fourth floor and walked to room 426. At the door to the room, Cyrus held up a hand.
"I haven't talked to Alice since last night, so I'm going to go in and see how he is first, then I'll be right back out."
"Of course," Vivian said, as Cyrus stepped inside. Nathaniel looked around the long hallway at the new environment. A green stripe was painted on the wall at his eye level. A nurse's station stood at the end of the hallway, an array of doors off to each side. Somewhere, the sound of a ventilator whooshed softly.
"I wish he'd have left us downstairs," Vivian said to no one in particular.
"It's uncomfortable standing in a hallway like this." "Interesting, though. Never seen any place like this. The vibrations are different here. I can feel so many worried, sad people." Vivian brushed the hair out of Nathaniel's eyes.
"We need to get you a haircut soon, don't we?"
Nathaniel smiled mischievously and shook his head. His bangs fell back in his eyes once again.
"I swear, when you smile like that, I don't know if you're an angel or a devil."
Cyrus opened the door and stepped back into the hall. He shook his head and stared at the floor.
"I don't know, Vivian. He did fine overnight, but he's taken a turn this morning. The doctors..."
Vivian laid her hand on his arm.
"I'm so sorry. We shouldn't be here."
She came to a sudden decision.
"Don't worry about us. I'll call Andy, and she'll come and pick us up. You've got enough to worry about without thinking about us, too."
Cyrus shook his head.
"No, Alice still wants to try. I know we're grasping at straws here, but that's all we have left."
Vivian hesitated, but Creech kneeled down, looked Nathaniel in the eye.
"You wouldn't mind just coming in and saying hello to my little boy, would you, Nathaniel?"
Nathaniel's wide blue eyes grew a tick larger. Vivian sighed.
"Really? This is a time for family."
Cyrus stood back up.
"But I understand. Okay, let's go in."
She looked down at Nathaniel.
"Just be quiet in there, okay, honey?"
Nathaniel nodded and took Vivian's hand. Inside, the room was mostly dark. The shades were pulled, the overhead light was off. The only source of light in the room was the greenish glow from various monitors and a subdued recessed light over the bed. Alice and Cyrus Creech stood together in a huddled puddle of misery and worry, looking down at their son. Byron Creech was 3 years older than Nathaniel, but laying in the hospital bed, he looked like a child heedlessly thrown into a dryer and allowed to shrink. Alice Creech left Cyrus's side and reached out to Vivian. Her face was dry, but her eyes shone with tears recently cried. She had once been pretty, but now she was drawn and worry lines were deeply etched around her eyes.
"Mrs. Hanrahan,"
Vivian nodded.
"Thank you so much for coming."
Nathaniel's head was turning on a swivel, taking in the strange beeps, antiseptic smells, and wires running everywhere. A small picture of Jesus was on the bedside table, where Byron and his parents could readily see it.
"And this is Nathaniel, of course," Alice said.
She reached down and lightly touched his head with a sad smile.
"He's a healthy, beautiful boy."
Vivian took Alice's hand and held it between her own.
"I'm so sorry, Mrs. Creech. I can't even imagine how difficult this is."
She turned and took a step toward the bed and looked down at Byron. He had once been a blonde, chubby little boy, but now was bald, with sunken cheeks. Vivian laid a hand on Byron's leg through the blanket. He didn't stir. Nathaniel stared at the boy, but didn't approach him. Alice and Cyrus stood a few steps back, obviously praying for a miracle they couldn't imagine, but were doing their best to believe. A long minute passed in silence. Then Nathaniel moved to the head of the bed. He reached his mind out, looking for Byron. For the first time since they had entered the room, Byron's eyes opened. He turned his head so he could see Nathaniel, but his eyes were uninterested. Nathaniel cocked his head and held eye contact with Byron.
There you are. Oh, you are so sick. It's everywhere in you. It's killing you, and it is almost done.
He reached a hand out and laid it on Byron's shoulder. Byron closed his eyes. The numbers, flickering on the greenish monitors, were steady and unchanged. There was no opening of the skies, no hallelujah chorus, no anything. Nathaniel removed his hand and looked up at his mother. She reached down and picked Nathaniel up. She made her best attempt at a smile, failed miserably, and said,
"I really do think it's best if we just find our own way home, Cyrus. Byron and Alice need you here. I'll call Annie to come pick us up, then we'll grab a bite in the cafeteria while we wait for her. Please don't worry about us."
Disappointment etched across Cyrus's face. He had known it was unlikely that Nathaniel could do anything for them, but now that even that slim possibility was gone, he was forced to face the reality of what came next. Cyrus reached in his back pocket, pulled out his wallet, and fished out a $50 bill.
"Thank you, Vivian. We appreciate that you came all this way. Please give this to whoever gives you a ride for their time and gas."
Vivian considered, then took the money.
"Not at all necessary, but I'll give it to her. Thank you."
She hugged Alice, who she had met for the first time less than 5 minutes earlier, as if she was a lifelong friend. She reached a handout for Nathaniel, took a last glance at the quiet form in the bed, and let him out, so the creatures could be alone. 6 hours later, somewhat worse for the wear, Vivian, Andy, and Nathaniel rolled back into Tuple. It had been a long day, and the longest time he had ever been seat-belted into a back seat. By the time they hit the Tuple city limits, Nathaniel was ready to do something, anything. They stopped at the Dairy Queen at the edge of town for chocolate-dipped ice cream cones, using the money Cyrus had given them. They walked across the street to the small park to eat them. In the end, Vivian burned as much energy as Nathaniel, as she pushed him on the swing and the roundabout. Finally, she retreated to the bench with Andy, and watched Nathaniel chase after a grasshopper.
"Doesn't seem to have affected him, did it?"
"No, he seems like his perfect little Nathaniel self," Andy answered.
"It's too bad this whole trip turned out to be a wild goose chase, and it would have been much better to have seen Byron stand up on the bed and do jumping jacks, but..."
Vivian chewed the inside of her cheek.
"But I can't help but wonder. If that had happened, what would have been next?
Would word spread about the miracle boy of Tuble? Would reporters and TV trucks have been parked outside our little house?" She shook her head. "I guess I'm glad that God or fate or whatever it is that controls this universe let life take its own path."
"Miracle boy, huh?"
Andy squinted into the reddish glow of the setting sun. Nathaniel was running across the field, pretending to fly an imaginary kite.
"I don't know. Looks like every other 4-year-old I've ever met."
Chapter 6 Vivian held Nathaniel on her shoulder, while she slipped the key into her front door lock and let herself inside. She dropped her keys on the kitchen table and carried Nathaniel into his bedroom. She laid him on his bed, slipped his tennis runners and clothes off, and found his Batman pajamas that he had worn the night before, crumpled at the end of his bed. "Won't win me Mother of the Year awards," she said, slipping the PJs over his head.
"But I don't think anyone from the award committee is here in the bedroom at this moment."
"I like the Batman pajamas. I don't care if they smell kind of funny."
Vivian sniffed the PJ tops, then shrugged, and helped Nathaniel under the covers.
"Night, sweet boy."
"Night, Mama. I love you whole tiger, whole world."
Vivian had no idea where that phrase had come from, but Nathaniel had been saying it as his highest compliment of devotion for months.
"Whole tiger, whole world," she promised,
brushing the hair out of his eyes for one final time on the day. At the door to his room, Vivian paused.